Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine publishes original crime and mystery short fiction. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. In our podcast series, we bring you readings of short stories from the back issues of our magazine. And for this episode, we have Larry Light reading his story, 18 and a Half Minute Gap, which we published in our January-February 2015 issue. This story features President Richard Nixon as a character, and it was written and published before our last presidential election, 2016, but the story eerily foreshadows some of our current concerns in 2018. Larry Light is an award-winning financial journalist who has worked for the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and Business Week. He is also the author of the Karen Glick thriller series and numerous short stories. He is the former executive vice president of the Mystery Writers of America and now is the organization's treasurer. Listen to Larry Light's reading of 18 and a Half Minute Gap, then stay to hear him talk about his inspiration for the story.
Richard Nixon was unhappy. Alcohol wasn't helping his mood. He sat in his brown easy chair, frowning and muttering incoherently. The scotch was mostly drained from the glass, which sat next to his national security briefing book. Despite the late hour, he wore a suit and a tie, as usual. He seemed uncomfortable dressed up, but then he always seemed uncomfortable.
"It's a paradox," he rumbled.
Was he talking to me, or had he forgotten me? He liked to disappear into his head, like a hunted rabbit into a bramble patch, particularly when he was drinking. He drank a lot these days.
"A paradox how, Mr. President?" I ventured.
Some people thought Nixon was a fearsome, table-banging tyrant. A number of his White House aides never dared question him, even when he made no sense. I was not one of those aides. It was a warm evening outside, yet here a fire crackled in the hearth. Nixon loved a fire and ordered that the air conditioning be cranked up to make the room seem like a cozy corner on a cold winter's night. He had a lot of odd habits. In here, there were a few unspoken rules. The word Watergate was banned, for instance.
"Paradox. Jack Kennedy,"
he said, not looking at me. His slurring was noticeable, but not yet too bad. The light from the fireplace made his flaccid left cheek shimmer. It sported a dark coating of stubble that seemed like it would be hazardous to touch. I had never touched Nixon except to shake his hand when I joined the staff. What was he talking about? He hated JFK.
"Kennedy, sir?"
He shifted those watery eyes toward me. When Nixon looked at you, it was as if he were inspecting for design flaws.
"Kennedy taped people in secret. He did, too, not just me," he mulled for a moment. "Those tapes are mine. Nobody will get them."
The president loved to complain, especially lately. He thought it unfair to be criticized about his secret taping system when Kennedy did the same thing. A lot of other presidents did as well. Of course, when Kennedy was president, Congress and a special prosecutor weren't investigating the White House and demanding access to Oval Office recordings. But Nixon didn't make that fine distinction.
"Your tapes are protected by executive privilege, Mr. President."
He liked to hear his underlings parrot the administration's line. The White House position, as firm as a stone wall, was that the investigators had no constitutional right to the tapes.
"Damn right."
Because I was a woman, he refrained from the saltier expletives that sprinkled his casual conversation with male aides. He did consider himself a gentleman, among other things.
"They think they can get a court to force me to disclose my tapes? My God, there are sensitive matters at stake on them. What I said to Brezhnev? Not a chance they're getting my tapes,"
he mumbled to himself.
They'd never try to get Kennedy's tapes. Oh no, he had too much charisma.
He pronounced the last word as if it were what a dog left on the sidewalk. He kept me in his gaze, and I waited. It wasn't one of those lustful looks I got from most of the men in the West Wing, from the chief of staff on down. Nixon treated me as he did his daughters. Well, as he did Julie, the smart one, whom he liked to complain to. Julie had gone to Smith. He spent less time with Tricia, the pretty one. His maudlin, sozzling rambles upset her and made her cry. Tricia had attended Finch, a finishing school masquerading as a college. I wasn't sure whether the First Lady cared that I kept company with the President here in the Lincoln sitting room by night. Would she object to her husband's being alone with a young woman? If it were Kennedy's wife, there would be a good reason to be concerned. Nixon, though, was as asexual as a drainpipe. I suspect he appreciated that I questioned him, respectfully, to be sure. One night, when the struggles with the Senate Watergate Committee reached a flashpoint, he had said to me with growling ire, "Who do these bastards think they are? I'm the President of the goddamn United States of America. I can walk into the next room and send a signal and 100 million Russians will be dead." This remark sent a few gigawatts jolting through my spine, even though I knew I shouldn't take him seriously. "You don't mean that, Mr. President," I said. "The Kremlin is a better friend to you than, say, Capitol Hill." He appeared to appreciate the sentiment and calmed down. So tonight, Nixon pushed himself out of his easy chair and shuffled to the liquor cabinet. He didn't like keeping an open bottle beside him. He figured that was low class. At 60, he moved like an old man. I knew his leg hurt. Nixon clinked a few ice cubes into his glass. Two missed and fell on the carpet. He didn't notice. I ignored them, not wanting to embarrass him. He sloshed more scotch over the ice. He took a sip before tottering back to his chair. "Another paradox," he said again. He held the drink reverently against his belly. "What is, sir?" The small glass of sherry that I had been nursing was perched beside me. Nixon reminded me of my father, who drank too much. But my father was a mean drunk who yelled and hit his kids. Nixon was mostly a melancholy drunk, aside from the casual threats to unleash nuclear hellfire.
"Paradox. The Russians made my damn career. My enemies. The enemies of America and of freedom. Without them, I'd never have made it past congressman from Whittier."
"Everyone admires your anti-communist achievements, sir."
"Men adore it when women flatter them. That goes double for powerful, important men, even those with the sexuality of a fire log."
"Not everyone," he said into his glass as he took yet another drink. "Damn liberals hated me for it. Still do. That snotty Algirdas, he was a Russian spy. He worked for Roosevelt and thought he was untouchable. One of the smart set. When I exposed Hiss, the liberals acted like I puked on the table of one of their fancy Georgetown dinner parties." This was on Nixon's mind because the night before he drank so much that he vomited. "Of course, they never invited me to their parties."
He said that proudly, although I detected a ghost of regret.
"They're lost, Mr. President."
The high-minded liberals never understood how smart Nixon was. He had an encyclopedic mind full of arcana about history, geography, politics, and personalities. With the last, he focused on people's weaknesses.
"They love Henry. He goes to their parties," Nixon said, staring into the fire.
No wonder. Secretary of State Kissinger had two traits Nixon lacked, humor and charm.
"Listening to you and him talk about foreign affairs is like a graduate seminar, Mr. President."
I was being sincere. Kissinger avoided visiting Nixon in the evening when he was drinking, but their daytime confabs were very instructive. I listened intently to them and committed what they said to memory. Nixon swung his unsteady gaze back toward me.
"Where do you go to school again?"
"Notre Dame undergrad, Ohio State for my graduate work."
"Good. Not the damn Ivy League, snotty people there. Kennedy, he went to Harvard, of course."
"Dr. Kissinger went to Harvard, sir. He was on the faculty." Nixon muttered to himself and took another drink.
Then, "Henry and I agree on a lot of things, you know. Ever read Oswald Spengler, The Decline of the West?"
"I did, Mr. President. My master's thesis was on Spengler."
Nixon nodded. He may have been impressed, although very little impressed a cynic like him.
"Well, you ought to know, then. Spengler felt that Western civilization was done for, and he was right. Henry and I agree on that. We don't make our beliefs public, for obvious reasons."
"I can see that wouldn't be a great campaign slogan, sir."
He ignored my jest. I had never seen him laugh, really. Fake laughs at social occasions, yes. The White House seldom held a social occasion anymore.
ever since Watergate made Nixon into a hunted animal. My job is to manage the decline.
You've felt this way for some time, haven't you?
His eyes became slits. He glowered at me. How do you know that?
I pay attention.
Nixon slumped back in his easy chair. He put the drink down beside him. You're damn right. I have known we were washed up ever since World War II. So what if we're the richest country in the world? That counts for nothing anymore.
Therefore, the Soviet Union will triumph.
This was less a question for me than a statement. Studying the fireplace, Nixon said, Of course they will. We are weak, and they are strong. We lack purpose, and they are committed to winning. Their military far outnumbers ours. If they attack Europe, they'll be in Paris in a few days. Our oil is running out. The Soviets are discovering new fields all the time. Look at how easily the Arabs embargoed us, not sending us a drop of oil. They don't fear us. They fear Russia.
The U.S. economy is falling apart, I said.
Nixon shook his head in disgust. What a disgrace. Inflation is eating us alive. We don't innovate like we used to. Companies are throwing people out of work right and left. American corporations only think about the next quarter. The Russians, though, plan for decades into the future. Their economic growth is better than ours. They're catching up. Everyone in Russia pulls in the same direction. They're all fanatical followers of Marxism, dedicated to their cause. Meanwhile, we believe in nothing. Our kids are all hippies, smoking pot and burning flags, with no work ethic.
Communism does seem to be on the march, I said.
Absolutely. Nixon grabbed his glass and took a hearty swig, but he spilled some in his tie. Ah, hell! He was a clumsy man, drunk or sober. I said,
Marxist insurgencies are springing up everywhere. Latin America, Africa, Asia. Communist terror cells are proliferating all across Europe. The Red Brigades in Italy, the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany, on and on.
Nixon laid down his glass again and rubbed the stain on his tie uselessly. The Reds are taking over in Southeast Asia, financed by Moscow. Any minute, they'll gain control in Laos and Cambodia. Henry negotiated a peace in Vietnam, which is a fig leaf for our retreat. Within the year, communist tanks will roll into Saigon. Mark my words, they know we're too weak and cowardly to come back.
Well, I said, when Red tanks roll into Washington, I suspect you will be well treated. You are a friend.
Nixon rumbled deep in his throat and sank deeper into his chair. Under me, the Russians got an arms treaty and detente. No more idiotic confrontations. Kennedy and his charisma. The sarcastic pronunciation again. Almost got us into nuclear war over Cuba in 1962. That would never have happened if I had won the 1960 election.
I heard someone stirring outside and rose. You have been a good friend, but my Uncle Yosef is concerned.
Nixon shot upright in his chair. You're with Yosef?
Yes, sir, I am.
My lord, he's concerned about what? I said the forbidden word.
Watergate, what else? He fears for your future. This was the first time I ever heard Nixon raise his voice.
My future? Tell him it is solid. I'll get past this.
In particular, Uncle Yosef is concerned about the tapes.
He jabbed his finger in the air. Which will never see the light of day. Executive privilege. Tell Yosef that.
We don't know what visitors said in the Oval Office that was recorded. There's a passage on the tapes Uncle Yosef does not like, and he wants something else, too.
Like what? Nixon growled.
I must meet with him to get further instructions on how you will proceed. He leaned forward, angry.
Tell him I am the president of a goddamn United States of America. Nobody tells me what to do.
I summoned up my friendliest smile. Yosef is your uncle, too, Mr. President.
Uncle Yosef's face was dried up and creased as the bottom of an empty riverbed. His long life was one of speaking quiet words in shadowy places. Yosef's eyes bulged from his sockets and never rested. They identified and classified every living organism within a 100-meter radius. Despite his many years, he had the visual power of a high-flying, predatory bird. He sat on a bench in Lafayette Park, across from the White House,
with his hands folded primly on his lap, almost prayerfully. But Uncle Yosef did not believe in God. He believed in history and its inevitable course. A statue of the Marquis de Lafayette stood nearby atop a white pedestal, marred by graffiti. While Lafayette's statue was not the largest, the park was named after him. The Americans had strange priorities. I returned to the bench with food. Carrying a colorful paper carton, I sat down next to Uncle Yosef. I opened the hot carton, careful not to get grease on my skirt. It was an Egg McMuffin, an addictive breakfast sandwich that one of the capitalist cesspools had produced a couple of years before. This food substitute was dedicated to further fattening already porky American youngsters whose physical fitness eroded year after year. Those high-resolution cameras, known as Yosef's eyes, fixed on my breakfast.
"You're now thoroughly American," he said in English, which carried barely a trace of accent. "Calories and carcinogens, a triumph for the world's other superpower." I offered the carton. "Would you like some, Uncle?" He waved a hand dismissively. "I would rather feast on rat poison." He got straight to the point. "Does Tricky Dicky understand what must be done?" "I will inform him tonight, Uncle. The tape problem should not be difficult to fix. The other one is more challenging." "All will be resolved. I know Nixon very well. He is a low-level sneak without finesse." Across Pennsylvania Avenue, a line of slat-gutted, knobby-kneed tourists stretched, awaiting admittance to the White House. The executive mansion's fountain burbled happily about the only happy activity on the premises. "Did you know that I personally fed him Alger Hiss in 1948? Hiss's usefulness to us as a spy was over. Without me, no Hiss. Without Hiss, no Nixon." "Yes, Uncle," I said, hoping that my breakfast sandwich would soon reach its radioactive half-life and I could eat it. "But Nixon does have a good command of geopolitics."
"I am not impressed by him as a statesman," Yosef said. "Nixon needs the German, that Kissinger, to guide him." He gestured at four statues in the park. "Four foreign generals, two Frenchmen, a Pole, and a German. They defeated the British for the Americans. Too bad for the Americans that the generals are not around to defeat us." I pointed at the largest statue, of Andrew Jackson astride a rearing horse. "Jackson was American-born and a good general." Yosef shrugged. "They named the park after one of the Frenchmen. Besides, Jackson only excelled at killing Indians. Easy work." The Egg McMuffin was still too hot, but I bravely bit into it. After I swallowed the first overheated mouthful of the latest pathetic example of American ingenuity, I asked, "Uncle, what if Nixon does not go along?" I asked this in Russian. Uncle Yosef answered in English. "The Americans are a frivolous people, but they have one wise saying. Dick Nixon before he dicks you." Uncle Yosef had no qualms about using crude language around women. This was refreshingly revolutionary. That night, I arrived at the Lincoln sitting room and nodded my way past the two Secret Service agents guarding the door. They were tall and hard as the Rocky Mountains and reminded me that not every American was soft. Nixon, who sat in his easy chair, was not alone. The chief of staff, who assumed his post after Watergate washed out his predecessor, had a sour expression, as if he had bitten into a maggot-ridden potato. Alexander Haig rested his gaze on me, more accurately, upon my breasts. "What is she doing here, Mr. President?" asked Haig, an Army general who had tried to lead troops during the Americans' humiliation in Vietnam. Nixon rumbled a reply into his glass before sipping scotch. "Vanessa and I are discussing history. She has a master's in poli-sci from Ohio State." "Not Harvard. Ohio State."
"With due respect, sir," Haig said, still fascinated by my bust, "it appears unseemly for a young woman to be alone night after night with the president."
"If my name was Jack Kennedy, maybe," Nixon said. "Don't worry, Al. It's been years since I..." "Never mind."
The fire's glow caught the amber hue of his scotch. The ice clicked against the side of the glass. Scowling, Haig walked past me, saying he'd be in the Situation Room. His eyes managed to find mine. "Good evening, General," I said and closed the door behind him.
"Some sherry, Vanessa?"
Nixon was faux-friendly. It had to do with anxiety over Uncle Yosef, certainly. When I shook my head, he said, "And?" "Uncle Yosef is worried about the visit he paid you on June 20th, 1972, in the Oval Office. You discussed President Kennedy. He did not know a tape was recording." Realization moved across Nixon's baggy face like a cold dawn.
"You're right. We did discuss that," he thought for a moment. "But who cares? No one will hear the tapes. Executive privilege. Those bloodhounds after me have no standing to demand my tapes."
I told him what Uncle Joseph required regarding the tapes. "No arguments. Make it happen." Nixon wasn't used to that tone. I added, "Mr. President."
"How dare Yosef give orders to the president of..."
But then he finally registered the menace in my posture. If I wanted, I could break his neck in two like a rotten branch. He reached for the phone.
"Okay."
After he finished, I said, "Wait here. Once I am done, we have another item Uncle Yosef wants to discuss." Nixon, his hand on the phone, contemplated his wingtips. My heart slammed like an overtaxed runner's. I hurried down the stairs toward the first floor and strode toward the West Wing, where the nation's business got conducted daily. Various white-shirted guards stood about, measuring me. I moved down the paneled corridors. A Secret Service agent waited beside the door to the office of the president's personal secretary. After I entered, he locked the door behind me. And the audio tapes were stacked neatly atop a credenza, each labeled with a marker pen by date. The secretary, Rosemary Woods, was transcribing them in the unlikely event they must be released. I'd heard that she hadn't yet reached June 20, a few days after the Watergate break-in. I quickly found the tape for that date. I snapped it into the Uber 5000 tape player and listened with the sound turned low. From the counter, I could tell Uncle Yosef's visit lasted a mere 18 and a half minutes. The atmosphere was tense from the outset.
"Yosef, you're in a jam with these Watergate burglars who we both know are linked to your political organization. How stupid. Trying to bug the Democratic National Committee and getting caught breaking into its office? Simply inept.
Nixon,
you shouldn't have come. What do you want?" Yosef, get rid of them. Use the CIA. Use your Secret Service.
Nixon,
are you kidding? I can't do that. This isn't Russia.
Yosef,
don't be weak. We have taken care of you all along the way. Don't forget what we did with Kennedy in Dallas and his brother Bobby in Los Angeles. Cleared the way for you.
Nixon,
my God, don't say that. They'd impeach me if they found out.
I reflected that now Congress is going to impeach him anyway. He lacked the backbone to do what he needed with the burglars. Using a small Japanese recorder of my own, the Americans had fallen very far behind on technology due to their corruption and laziness, I took down the Yosef-Nixon exchange for insurance later. Then on the Uber, I erased the entire conversation. My mouth was as dry as chalk. I left Woods' office and returned to the Lincoln sitting room. En route, I could feel the guards checking out my rear. The two massive agents flanking Nixon's door seemed not to notice me. First, drawing in a breath, I twisted the knob. "It's done," I told the president. He held his half-consumed scotch on his crotch, as though protecting his manhood. Good luck with that.
"Kennedy, him and his charisma."
Nixon appeared to be talking to his drink.
"He thought he was so cool."
His using the word cool surprised me. During the student march on Washington over his Cambodia invasion, Nixon had visited protesters at dawn. On the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, he tried to make awkward small talk with these hippies, nattering on about college sports. The man was clueless. The door safely sealed behind me, I said, "Uncle Yosef has one more requirement of you." Eyes hooded in anger, Nixon gave me a look of hatred that would do Stalin proud.
"You will address me as Mr. President."
I didn't. "You will resign, right now. We don't trust you anymore."
"Never!"
he shouted. He spilled his precious drink on the carpet. I sensed the door opening behind me. Over my shoulder, I saw the two agents surging in. Their weapons were drawn, both with fat silencers. I felt the bullets sear through me, pulverizing my heart and smashing my ribcage. I fell forward. The blood was pouring wet from my front and from my back. Blood filled my mouth. As I lay twitching and dying, I heard Nixon above me.
I will never leave. I'm the president of the goddamn United States of America.
Thank you, Larry, for that dramatic reading of 18 and a half minute gap. The story is from the January-February 2015 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. When we recorded the story, Larry spoke to us a bit about how he came to write the story.
Richard Nixon was a very tricky guy. They called him Tricky Dicky. And I'd say there's some resonance to our times, although I published this story before the most recent presidential election. Nonetheless, he's a man who's always fascinated me because he was a brilliant man, but at the same time, he was a very devious man, and he had a real dark side, which I find just fascinating. He wasn't above twisting the truth, to say the least. In fact, when he ran and won his first congressional race after World War II, in California, he ran against an incumbent Democrat for Congress named Helen Gehagen Douglas. He called her the Pink Lady because of her alleged Marxist affiliations, which were non-existent. But you have to say in a way that it was effective. And at the time, it stirred up a lot of people who were afraid, obviously, of the Soviet Union, and it propelled him on to higher office. But it turned out that he came undone because of those very things that made him who he was.
I hope you enjoyed listening to Larry Light reading his story, 18 and a half minute gap, from the back issues of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is published by Dell Magazines and Penny Publications. To learn more about us, we urge you to go to our website, themysteryplace.com, look for us on Facebook, or on our blog, traceevidence.net. You can find the magazine at your newsstand. Digital editions are available at all major e-tailers. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.